J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de la queue. Pète, pète, elle, deux, elle, bande, la dôme, la coule.
Welcome to the Nerd Kitchen. This is Max, and with me, I have Macro Ajit. If you remember last time, we left off right where we were talking about the different flavors. And in this episode, we're going to talk about the tastes and how they affect our food. Let's move on to the different types of tastes.
Okay.
I always try to go for something that's local. So yeah. You know, there'll be a recipe for sarson ka saag. Right? Yeah. Something like sarson ka saag. I don't get sarson here. Right?
Yeah.
And so then like, okay, I don't get sarson, but I have all the remaining things to make the saag. And then That's where I bring in, okay, flavor profile wise, taste wise, what is closest to our sarson, and you know, and so French sorrel is what I found. You know, it has the same bite as what like mustard would have, but then it's grown locally here in the Midwest. And so I use French sorrel to make sarson ka saag. You know,
Okay.
French sorrel ka saag doesn't sound very sexy, but
It does. Why not?
Yeah, it has not French. You can put French beet in front of anything.
I know. Yeah, pretty much.
So coming to the tastes generally are four. I mean, is what you know. A lot of people will tell you is bitter, salty, sour, and sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and then nowadays there is this huge thing called umami, which is the fifth taste. Mm-hmm. In Indian Asian kind of cooking, you have hot also, which is one of the tastes. Right, spicy food like a taste. I think in Indian cooking, like astringent is also one of the tastes.
Yeah,
it's not in all parts of the country, but I think in the south and all that, astringent also is one of the tastes. So let's talk a bit about these tastes.
Actually, I think the words hot and spicy are sort of used interchangeably, which is kind of unfortunate because there are things that could be hot but not spicy and vice versa. For example, if you take certain food items, they may have a lot of spices. You have cumin, you have turmeric, you have asafoetida, you have some amount of chili, you have cinnamon, you have clove. So basically, when you throw in a little bit of garam masala or a sambar podi or a goda masala, and that is spicy in the sense that it has a lot of spices. But it doesn't have to be hot, right? But on the other hand, you have something else like a red chili paste. It is absolutely hot, but not spicy because it has only one condiment, which is pretty much the chili, maybe some salt and oil just to help you grind that stuff. So those are the two extremes. And when somebody says that, you know, this food is very spicy, and when they're making it, that whatever, my tongue is on fire type of sound, to me, that's kind of odd because what you're saying is the food is hot. Of course, there are a lot of food items that are hot and spicy. But to me, hot and spicy are two distinct terms which are used interchangeably, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. And asafoetida, I think, falls more under this astringent taste, doesn't it?
I'm not sure about that, but I know it for a fact that when you taste tea, astringency is a very key element because that is
tea and pomegranate juice for sure.
Yes, pomegranate juice is a good example of something that is, again, and amla. I think amla also, when you taste, you get that puckering sensation on your tongue. It's different from the lemon sourness because sour taste also makes your tongue pucker a little bit. But astringency is that dryish sensation that is left on your tongue once you're done consuming.
Yeah, exactly. Astringent is when these compounds in the food bind to the your receptors, and therefore it leaves your tongue dry or puckering.
Yes.
Like you just said. So persimmon is one of the fruit which is an astringent. Teas, juices, those things are astringent.
Yeah.
I think in some places, in some cultures, cooling also is a taste that menthol, the chemical menthol that you get, if you check from mint oils, that also is sort of like a taste.
Mm. Okay, that's very interesting. Yeah.
Umami, I've had a hard time understanding it very much. Umami is a Japanese word, right?
Yeah.
It means savory. And it's meaty lip smacking sensation, which is which is triggered by glutamates, right? The amino acids and glutamates. Mushroom has a high amount of glutamates and things like that. The thing that a lot of people don't understand is tomatoes actually have a high amount of glutamate in them amongst all the vegetables.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. Because on one of these episodes on Chef's Table, there is a place called Ivan Ramen in Japan. So there's this American guy who moves to Japan and now probably makes one of the best ramen, has one of the most popular ramen places on earth. The way he sort of creates his, carves his own niche is by actually finding that tomato is actually an umami flavor bomb, to quote him. So it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that tomato has that umami taste, because tomato is actually a very good example of something that is umami. Although we tend to associate that with, you know, sweetness and as a saring agent. And I think, speaking of those things, that's probably entirely dedicated to a different episode altogether.
And then, so shiitake mushrooms, so dried shiitake mushrooms, they have a lot of umami or glutamate in them. And the other one, and this is what I thought you were going to talk about, is actually MSG.
Okay.
MSG gets a very bad rap. It's funny now because I read about it recently that was not a thing in India growing up. You know, I thought it was a conspiracy. My mom didn't want me to eat too much Chinese food. Therefore, she, you know, you'd say things like that. But then I realized it was like a worldwide conspiracy, because in the US also, or even in Europe, these chefs, MSG was banned. MSG was banned. And these chefs would smuggle packets of MSG in their pockets and then take a pinch and put it on their dish. And there was a huge... I think New Yorker did a piece on that. I'm not sure. There's a huge long form article on the war against MSG that has happened in the West. And some say it is more like a conspiracy, because they knew that if you let MSG prosper, then the Western foods wouldn't have any way to counterattack these Asian flavors.
Yeah, that's just a very valid point. And just to build on that, I think it may also be worthwhile talking to someone who knows more about it from a chemical perspective. Because MSG is one type of glutamate, right? It's monosodium glutamate. Whereas when we say glutamates, which are even present in rice, noodles, I believe, even parmesan, the mushrooms, glutamates would be a class of compounds. So as a class of compounds versus isolating MSG, how is that meaningful, or how does that make sense? Because you can't say that fine, MSG as a chemical when ingested beyond certain amounts, that is one thing. But to say that MSG is harmful, I'm not too sure, because obviously it's not like you're eating heaps of MSG all the time.
And then the one that has the highest amount of glutamates is actually seaweed, which is why it's used in sushi and... I've always wondered, what is the whole deal with sushi? It's just rice and whatever, fish or what meat or whatever that's just wrapped in the seaweed. Now, why is it such a big thing? And then when I realized, the seaweed has so much, is high in glutamate, so it's that umami that comes out of eating sushi, which makes people... which is why it's so overpriced and
and addictive too, I guess. good sushi is seriously good sushi.
When it comes to addictive, sweet, anything that is sweet or anything that is fatty is the most addictive, right? And if you think why, and I only learned now since we have a kid, is that the breast milk that you get is full of fat and sugar. Those are the two main things that are in breast milk, right? So it's the first thing that you're consuming as a kid. And so it's what latches on into your memory. So because breast milk has such a high fat content and sugar, which is why it's part of, it's just ingrained in your mind. And therefore, anytime you see something that is fatty or that has sugar in it, you know, you just go crazy. And chocolate is that, you know, it has the best of the both. It has sugar and a lot of fat. From birth, you know, our signals are, have just been telling us that, you know, go for fat, go for sweet. And that's what chocolate does to us.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting that whenever you're feeling really hungry, you get that, that cranky feeling because of hunger. Usually you reach for sugar. It's kind of interesting to know how sugar also plays tricks with your brains.
So the thing about bitter food is bitter foods get a very bad rap.
Oh yeah, unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately. And I thought we should talk a little about that. Because there's a primitive part of our brain that just rejects bitter taste by default, you know, and this could probably be from an evolution standpoint as well, because like toxic plants, you know, taste bitter therefore in our DNA, if it's bitter, it's toxic and you avoid it and things that, and that could be, I don't know. I'm not qualified to make that. I'm just putting two and two together, but, and therefore, uncooked like artichoke leaves or rhubarb or things like that. I don't even want to go near Karela. I'm not even mentioning Karela.
Come on. Karela rocks, man. Karela rocks. You have some good Bharwa Karela or like a good Karnataka style Karela goju. Yeah, that opinion has to change.
However, what I would talk about is how you can neutralize bitterness. Salt, okay, I have found is a very good way to neutralize bitterness.
Salt and sweet too, right? I mean, you add a little bit of sweetness to it, that works wonders as well. So you make, say, when you're and of course frying the crap out of it in oil doesn't hurt either. Any hot chips, if you have Karela chips, it's damn good. You can actually bear any bitterness as long as it's sliced thinly and just, you know, presented to you in its most glorious deep fried form. But I think a little bit of sweet. So that's why I really like the pitle and the goju that's made with Karela, because there is an element of salt, there's an element of sweetness in it, and that really makes the whole thing a lot more fun to eat.
If you eat caco, it is pretty bitter. So is raw coffee or tea or even hops that they use in beer. They're all bitter.
But I think the evolution point of view may be kind of interesting, because as you said, a lot of these, I mean, you take neem for example, it is bitter. You take the leaf or the that neem flower or the fruit, they are all essentially bitter things, and they are also considered to have a lot of antimicrobial properties. And it also helps to ward off pests and predators in many cases, right? So maybe there is that evolution component may have something to do with. But at the end of the day, I think it's the balance of flavors that we taste which makes food sort of fun, right? Because we have to understand that bitterness is not, see, when you taste Karela, it's tasting extreme form of bitter, just like you're tasting extreme form of heat when you bite into a bhoot jholokia or something and then just wince in pain for a long, long time. If you look at other things where the bitterness is subtle and combined with other flavors, for example, you take rosemary as an example, you take thyme, a lot of these herbs, they have that bitter sensation, but they're beautifully balanced by the aromatic oils that are contained in those herbs. Rosemary being my favorite example. You bite into a piece of rosemary, it tastes bitter. It tastes other things. It definitely tastes bitter. But then again, you add rosemary to any sauce, it just takes it to a whole new level. So I think we probably need to expand the scope of definition of bitterness in food. Some cases to me, like a lot of these herbs, which are having that element of bitterness in addition to the aromatic oils, they really elevate the experience of food and, you know, take things to a whole new level. But I think your original question was, how does it play tricks with our brain or our tongues, like the way you know, sweet food does? I think that is, again, probably I think we could probably do an episode on, you know, these receptors and how, where are these different receptors located and
on the tongue,
what sort of signals they trigger to the brain. I think that itself is a very nice topic of discussion.
Yeah, because if we move on to like salt, salt is what brings fullness to a dish.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, because otherwise a dish has this flat flavor. And that is why I have arguments with people sometimes where I say salt is just, we have this whole thing, right? What pinch of salt? Every recipe will say pinch of salt.
Yeah.
What
is
a pinch of salt? And the nerd in me is like, okay, what is it? Is it like quarter teaspoon, 1.5 grams? What is it?
Mm.
Because no one, you have measurements, everything, 2 tablespoons of this, but they'll just say pinch of salt.
Yeah.
And it can act as a flavor enhancer as well. Like they just take mussels and just sprinkle them with salt and that's it. But the way I think of it is, like when people make bagels or even ice cream or brownies, you sprinkle sea salt and the taste is elevated to a completely different level, you know, when salt is used as a topping, like a coarse variety of salt.
I think with salt, see again, because if you taste food without salt, not all the receptors on your tongue are activated, because salt receptors reside at a particular location of the tongue. They are not like omnipresent. So that's probably why when you have food with salt, it is activating then 100% of the variety of the gustatory receptors as opposed to less than 100%, which is probably why you get a more holistic experience of the entire sensorial gamut of food that you're eating. So I guess that may have to do with why salt is so important to food when it's added in the right amount. And of course, there are a couple of things which are very interesting to me from when you talk about salt is how the whole salted caramel and how the addition of salt in cookies plays a very, very crucial role. Because a cookie with that very, very subtle hint of salt, I kind of tend to enjoy that a lot more than the cloying sugary cookies. And the regular caramel is good, but and maybe it's my personal view, but when you have that salted, slightly salted caramel, I think that is also a great example of how you can combine those two elements and really take caramel to a whole new level.
Right. And since we just spoke about salt and bitterness, there is one thing I thought was important to mention, and that is super tasting. Super tasting is where a group of people detect compounds as being unbearably bitter compared to, you know, medium tasters or regular tasters, as we call, who find compounds just bitter, but not overwhelmingly bitter. Apparently, Asians, these sub-Saharan Africans, indigenous Americans and all that, they have a much higher chance of being super tasters than others. And so when you said all of Madras, you are not far off. It could well be true. We never know.
Okay.
I mean, the only way to truly tell if you are a super taster is if you use these strips that they call the PTC strips, phenylithiocarbamide strips. And, you know, that's when you place it on your tongue. If it is extremely bitter, you are a super taster. And if you're not, it will just be like a very mild, bitter taste. I don't know if we have to talk about sweet or not. I think it's there. It's almost in our entire discussion. We've been going back and forth between sweets. But like I mentioned, right, because it comes from breast milk, our desire for sweetness changes in our lifespan. As we mature, our preference for sweetness also decreases.
See, there are different types of sugar. There is glucose, there is sucrose, there is sucralose, there is lactose, galactose, all kinds of things. And how does the metabolism for all these? Because when we say sugar is the enemy...
Galactose is real? You didn't make that up?
I think it is fairly real.
It seems like something from a Marvel movie, but yeah. Go on.
Yeah, I mean,
galactose.
No, it is a sugar. No, galactose is very real. I have no doubt about that. So again, what types of sugars are present in what kinds of food? That also, I think, is something that we, you know, need to consider before making like a sweep. You see, the answer could be true that sugar, you know, hurts or whatever. But I think the kind of thought process that goes into it before making such a statement to me, at least as a scientist, is very important. That we kind of understand as opposed to, you know, make sweeping generalizations all the time.
The last section I want to talk about before we go is probably my favorite, and in what everything I do is these combination of these tastes. And when you bring these two together, it's crazy. Like when you put salt on grapefruit or lime juice on watermelon or peaches or even watermelon with the salty feta cheese.
Or jaggery in sambar, which is very good, but that is also a controversial topic.
Jaggery and sambar is a Bangalore thing. I refuse to talk.
No, it's not a Bangalore thing. It's also done by Tams all the time. They just don't want to admit it, unfortunately.
But the other combination that's very close to home is the guava and chili pepper. Right? And those pairings, if you think about it, makes no sense. If you just put and say, oh, there is guava, there is red chili pepper, I'm going to put the two together. But when they come together, it does this miraculous thing in your mouth. You know? Same way you have mango salad, but you put jalapenos and cilantro in it, or strawberries with very little black pepper. I mean, I've done all these crazy things and I keep trying them. Sometimes they are successful, a lot of times they are futile.
I am not a big fan of this whole combining. So when you have this fruit chaat, I am not a fan of, because they add the chaat masala and salt.
Not the
on
chaat masala. I'm just saying just chili pepper on guava. Chaat masala is a huge heady concoction of already so many different flavors in it, and then like what are you tasting at the end, you
know? So to me, unfortunately, I suppose salt and chili also takes away from the natural taste of the food as opposed to enhancing it. Somehow, for some, I guess, strange reason, it doesn't work for me.
I've seen on your Instagram watermelon and feta cheese.
That that salad I love, but then the thing is that I look at it as a salad. But yeah, the point is...
But it's the pairing, right? It's the pairing of the salt and sweet.
That's a fair point. And even the raw papaya salad, I'm a huge fan of that, because that's also pairing something that is inherently sour, maybe a bit astringent too. If you talk about raw mango, you pair it with a bit of sweet, whatever, palm sugar, and you pair it with some lemon juice, and it tastes pretty damn good. So, but yeah, maybe I don't specifically like the salt and chili thing going on. I suppose it's kind of fun, right? Because that trend is now really picking up in ice creams also. Because a lot of these ice cream places are making, for example, tamarind ice cream. You have ice cream and then you have a bit of tamarind in it, and you just sprinkle a bit of chili powder on top. And then you have that. Of course, guava chili ice cream now is fairly mainstream as well. People are probably going to give me a lot of crap. I don't get chocolate and salt, or I don't get chocolate and chili. I definitely don't get chocolate and sea salt. To me, it's a, why are you taking these fancy beans and, you know, doing all the brilliant processing, retaining all the native flavors and aroma of chocolate, and freaking ruin it by sprinkling sea salt on top of it? So I don't get that.
Don't we add a pinch of salt to make brownies?
But then, see, then here salt becomes like a sort of a prominent element.
Oh, okay, okay. Like a garnish on top. Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't get that. Brownies, I mean, any dessert, but desserts are inherently sweet. The salt is, if need be, it's a very, very, very subtle thing. And to me, it's more of a cookie thing when I talk about salt. In my cakes and brownies, I do add a teeny bit of salt. But then again, I'm fine if my brownie doesn't have salt. But when it comes to cookies, it really elevates things. Yeah, if you just point blank add salt on a slab of chocolate, it's like you just ruined a nice expensive bar of chocolate. Why would you do that?
Chocolate Nazi, Macrojit, whoever knew. But you're right. And the other one that comes close to home is grilled corn and lime juice. Because you're taking the sourness from the lime juice and the sweetness from the grilled corn, and that comes together again brilliantly.
In a corn, there is more going on than just sweet. There is an element of savoriness in corn that fundamentally t- ties these flavors together. I can't say the same about a fruit where the fundamental thing going on is sweet and you quote unquote ruin it by adding salt and chili.
Let us end with something that is more close to your heart, where we bring bitter and sweet together. And okay. That is very evident in coffee and tea. You bring sugar or honey into it.
Yeah.
That is also one of those classic pairings where they're like, you never mix bitter and sweet, but tea, that's exactly what we do.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. And again, it is to accentuate certain things. See, just like with a savory preparation, salt in the right amount really takes things to the next level. Same, I don't know, maybe similar logic applies to sugar when it comes to bitter things. And again, this goes back to some of the things that we talked, right? The whole Karela thing, just to mask it, if you add a pinch of sugar, it really, I don't know, that combination, at least to me personally, works really, really well. So I think as a principle, you could look at it in a similar fashion where you add this small amount of sweetness to bitter and astringent things to really take them to the next level. I think one thing we need to realize is that, see, when it comes to tea, I can say that the tea drinking habits in India are very different. We are used to this whole milk tea with a lot of sugar, or some amount of sugar at least. So as a pairing, it works, because I'm not sure if you're looking at it from a taste point of view or if you're looking at it from the point of view of, look, I need to get some fuel inside my body, so might as well add some sugar to this so that it, you know, makes it a little heavy and I kind of enjoy my tea a little better. But I think that's probably digressing a little bit from what you had asked. But yeah, I think as a concept, it makes sense to combine bitter and sweet things. And it's kind of very interesting, right? Because there's a festival in Karnataka where they have this whole neem leaf and jaggery with other things, Devu Bela as we call it, where it not only, I suppose, brings the bitterness of the neem and the jaggery together, but also it's some sort of life philosophy is also associated with that. But I think it would be interesting to talk to someone about this from a chemistry point of view as well. So what's in those bitter things and what's in those sweet things, and how do they play tricks on our tongue, which eventually tells our brain that, boss, this particular bittersweet combination tastes amazing.
These wacky combinations of bringing in sour and sweet, or, you know, bitter and sour, things like that, which, you know, I find very challenging. I will leave you with one last one. I'm not kidding. This is true. Bananas with sharp cheddar cheese.
I personally don't think so, but I wouldn't mind giving it a shot.
Why you not? Should give it a shot.
Is that something you created, or is that something that actually exists out there?
I have no idea. I was playing with it.
You're playing with it?
I had some cheese that was going bad.
Now we know what the real purpose of this experiment is.
So on that note, thanks a lot, Ajit, for talking to us. And hope we'll do a few more of these in our section that we're calling Nerd Kitchen for now. So
I'd love to, Max. Thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yep. From one nerd to the other, this is a lot of fun. Hopefully our listeners will also like it. And we get good feedback to do more of these. But otherwise, thanks everyone for listening. This is Max and Ajit signing off. See you again pretty soon. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Alouette, 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 alouette.